The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Corporate earnings are recovering incredibly quickly and much more quickly than anyone had anticipated. And at the same time, companies are sitting on an incredible amount of cash, a record amount of cash by our reckoning. So it seems to us like we're going to see redeployment of dividends and a wave of repurchases again to sort of make up for the cuts to both of those programs over the course of 2020.
It's going to be necessary to get our fiscal house in order, but we don't need to get the fiscal house in order and shift to austerity soon. It doesn't have to be, you know, later this year, next year, or even in 2023 or 2024. Once the economy is fully healed, that's a time when you can go back and say, you know, maybe we need to raise taxes or cut government spending. That time will come, but for the next few years, it's not appropriate.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Gina Martin Adams, Chief Equity Strategist from Bloomberg, joins me this week. Gina remains bullish on the stock market, and she'll be here to tell you why and what sectors she thinks are set to outperform. Ryan Sweet from Moody's Analytics will be here to discuss the approaching inflation, which he sees as temporary, and why the economy could finally hit 6% growth rates this year. Then Chris Sheridan and I will discuss the coming spike in energy prices coming our way. But first, let's go to Ryan Poplava to discuss this week's market-moving events. Ryan?
For the most part, it was a quiet week on Wall Street. It was a short week to start off, with Monday closed for President's Day. And we entered the week with the S&P 500 already up 5.9% for the month of February, the NASDAQ up 7.8%, and the Russell 2000 up 10.6%. That is to say, with the kind of performance in just a short couple of weeks, it was no surprise that investors took some profits this week. Still, any dip that surfaced was bought quickly by bulls, as we saw a couple of intraday rallies stave off any large losses. The next wave of stimulus checks is being discussed in Congress, including an increase to the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour. Currently, Congress is looking at $1,400 stimulus checks per individual, so $2,800 for a married couple, plus another $1,400 per child or adult dependent, which could go to any individuals with income of $75,000 up to, head of households with up to $112,000, and married couples filing jointly up to about $150,000. But the details have not been finalized, so these amounts and limits and phase-outs could still be changed. The coronavirus stimulus package is working its way through the House and Senate under budget reconciliation, but the bill is expected to hit the floor for a vote next week. With that catalyst around the corner, it's no wonder sellers have been shy. Now, the primary catalyst moving the market this week was economics. Earnings were important, but they didn't have as significant of an influence on the whole as did the economic report, starting off with Wednesday's retail sales report, which was the most significant, showing in January sales were up solidly across every retail category. Sales were up 5.3% month to month, wiping out any disappointment over the downward revision for December's negative 1.8% decline. The second piece of news out Tuesday was a large jump in the producer price index, up 1.3%, the largest ever seen since the index began in December 2009. Oddly, the initial reaction to the news was a negative one in equities due to a sharp rise in long-term rates. Long-term yields, that's the 10-year treasury I'm referring to, hit 1.33%, but then settled down intraday to close at 1.3%, causing a buy-the-dip reaction in stocks once that treasury yield reversed. The long-term yield was also helped later in the day by the FOMC minutes from the January meeting, which was dovish, to no surprise, causing those long-term yields to drop. A couple of other key economic reports here. Industrial production continues its strength as well in January, up 0.9% after a downwardly revised increase of 1.3% in December. The key part of the report there was that the increase was there despite a decline in the index for motor vehicles and parts due to the shortage in semiconductors. Initial jobless claims increased 13,000 for the week ending February 13th, which continues to argue support for stimulus for industries hardest hit by COVID-19. Finally, housing starts dropped 6% in January, which doesn't bode well for the tightly supplied housing market as it stands right now, maintaining that rise in pricing. There were some developments for energy Friday after the Biden administration said U.S. officials would attend a meeting with Iran if hosted by the EU and if attended by other signers of the 2015 deal with Iran. So the olive branch was extended, and that was later backed up by a letter by the administration Thursday that the U.S. is withdrawing three letters from the Trump administration that by doing so effectively reinstates the sanction relief provided by the 2015 deal. So what happened to energy? West Texas Intermediate crude fell 2% Friday, back below $60 a barrel on this news. On the earnings front, let's talk about a few highlights this week. Walmart had healthy revenue growth of about 7.3% to $152 billion, but due to a significant rise in expenses, they missed on earnings, coming in at $1.39 versus expectations for $1.51 per share. The company repaid property tax relief in the UK. Expenses went up about $1.1 billion related to COVID. And then, of course, they increased wages across the board for U.S. workers, which overall saw an increase of 9.5% in their operating, selling, and administrative costs. So a big increase there. But behind the news, the company reported e-commerce sales jumped 79%, with overall comparable sales up 8.6% versus growth of only 6.4% in the previous quarter. So a big jump there. But the main reason the stock was down after earnings was due to poor guidance, which they said would come in at low single-digit growth for the year. The company, however, did announce big plans to invest $14 billion into its supply chain through technology and automation and plans to offer more healthcare products and services. Now, Shopify fell after earnings due to its high valuation and lower growth forecast. So similarly to Walmart trying to keep expectations down, their revenue growth was 94% during the quarter. Obviously stellar, as there's been a shift towards online storefronts continuing throughout COVID. Their sales were up over $5.1 billion this holiday season versus $2.9 billion in 2019. The company stated that it will continue to grow rapidly in 2021, so some good news there, but at a lower rate than in 2020, so there's the rub. The idea behind their caution may be due to the vaccine rollout suggesting some shoppers will return to brick-and-mortar shopping, therefore slowing the surge in e-commerce. Obviously, we've seen e-commerce grow beyond COVID, well before COVID, so it's not going to slow down Shopify very much. Finally, I would like to highlight Applied Materials. I've been talking a lot about a shortage of semiconductors across many industries. So who do we look to produce the manufacturing equipment and get a real good view on where things are going? That's Applied Materials. The company announced a beat on both revenues and earnings, but also increased guidance. So a good one there for both the consensus on revenues and earnings. The company sees robust demand for wafer fabrication equipment, which has emboldened the company's confidence of the current trends into 2021 and beyond. So the company sees trends caused by the pandemic driving investment into cloud data centers and communications infrastructure due to work from home, homeschooling, and online retail, in addition to many companies investing in automation, artificial intelligence, and the Internet of Things, IoT technologies, as I just mentioned Walmart is doing. That's it for this week. Some great earnings and economic news, but the main driver supporting stocks is continued talks of stimulus staving off any kind of profit taking at this time.
Felix Zuloff joined FS Insider to discuss his outlook on the economy, the markets, commodities, inflation, and much more. Here's a clip of what he had to say on FS Insider this week.
Our world economic system and financial system is built on growth. So we need growth to service our debt and to service all the liabilities, et cetera, et cetera. If we do not have growth, the system risks of breaking down and deflate. Now, the setup that we have is very deflationary. Population growth is so low and declining in trend that we can hardly get the growth that our system needs. So that's why our natural growth potential is probably less than 2% for the U.S., which is the best among the industrialized nations, and less than 1% for Europe. And based on that, the authorities have increased their involvement, and even that did not work. And I think we are now at the point where the authorities have realized you cannot only create money and liquidity and inject it into the financial system, you have to spend it. So I think we are at the beginning of a huge period where governments will increase their expenditures to create demand and growth in the world economy. That's coming.
To listen to this full 30-minute interview with Felix Suloff, including Felix's outlook on commodities, the stock market, the economy, and more, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Call now at 888-486-3939. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, for investors, 2021 is turning out to be another good year. Stock prices are up and at record levels. How long will this continue, and what will be the key drivers? Joining me on the program is Gina Martin Adams from Bloomberg. And Gina, you recently wrote an article, and one of the big possibilities is stock repurchase wave. Corporations are sitting on a lot of cash right now. Either raising dividends or buying back stocks, what would that mean for the market, number one? And number two, how would the Biden administration handle stock buybacks?
Yeah, all very, very good questions. Hence the reason we wrote the note. I think a lot of investors are focused on, are we going to see inflation pressures or will rates rise too much over the course of the year? But the reality of the situation is corporate earnings are recovering incredibly quickly and much more quickly than anyone had anticipated. And at the same time, companies are sitting on an incredible amount of cash, a record amount of cash by our reckoning, and also about 6% of total assets on the balance sheet, which is well above longer-term average of about 5%. So it seems to us like we're going to see redeployment of dividends and a wave of repurchases again to sort of make up for the cuts to both of those programs over the course of 2020. Our view is that we get about 15% dividend growth over the course of 2021 and maybe close to 50% growth in repurchases. Now, how will a Biden administration respond? I think is a tougher question, frankly, to answer. There are a couple of different things floating around Congress, none of them necessarily proposed directly by the Biden administration, so I'm not sure how much support they're ultimately going to have. We think it's a lot of smoke and mirrors so far, but if we do see a really strong wave of repurchases, we might see these programs start to pop up. One is direct taxation on repurchases themselves, which I'm not sure the mechanism by which we can do this. We obviously tax dividends. The idea is we could tax repurchases. How will that happen? I don't know. I think it's a really long shot for happening anytime in the next year, but certainly something to watch for over the course of 2021 if we do indeed get a really strong surge in capital deployment as we're anticipating.
You know, there's been some other proposals, Jen, and I wonder what impact, and maybe this is just smoke and mirrors as well, but talking about taxing unrealized gains based on, let's say, a certain net worth. So I just don't know how that would work. So if you have gains 1 year, you haven't taken any gains, you pay a tax on the unrealized gains. But what happens next year if you have a loss?
Yeah, I think that this is the problem is we are certainly moving into an environment where we're going to have to think about how do we pay for all the fiscal spending. Without a doubt, we've had an enormous amount of fiscal spending, and a record level of fiscal spending as a share of GDP in 2020. We're likely to fund even more in 2021. Come 2022, 2023, 2024, and beyond, we're going to have to start talking about how do we pay for this. Most assumptions at the regular policymaker level are that growth will overwhelm and ultimately growth will pay for the programs enacted. As we all know, that rarely actually occurs. Obviously, we all hope that we can grow our way out of debt, but it seems highly unlikely. The sum total is nobody knows exactly how we're going to pay for this. There are a lot of proposals out there. None of them have been passed yet, but I think over the course of the next 3 years, we are going to have to be on guard for what gets passed, how does it impact our investment strategies, and navigate accordingly. It's not likely in 2021, which does give the equity market some cover. It may not even be that likely by 2022, depending upon how rapidly we can grow out of this recession, how quickly we can get vaccinations deployed and the like. But it is something we need to be prepared to talk about going forward.
Yeah, because one thing that happened out of the financial crisis, Gina, when the Obama administration came out with the stimulus program, they did not raise taxes until the second term. They wanted to make sure the economy was on firm ground. Do you think the Biden administration would do the same? Because I'm trying to think with fiscal stimulus, monetary stimulus, what would bring this bull market to an end?
Well, this, I think, is why the market is actually so focused, or why the most investors are quite focused on what happens with long-term interest rates, because you don't really have to think about paying for debt until it gets really expensive. And by that, I mean, when you look at actual interest payments on the debt as a share of GDP, they've sort of bounced around between 2 and 3%. For the last several years. And even with the extraordinary growth in spending that we saw in 2020, interest payments are still not exploding. Well, what creates an explosion in interest payments is usually interest rates go higher. So to the extent that some of this debt is funded at shorter term interest rates, as interest rates go higher, interest payments will start to go higher. And then we have to really start to think about how do we fund the federal entities? How do we fund, you know, these interest payments over time without eating away at other government expenditures and government programs? So I think that's the trigger point. It does provide good case for why you want to watch rates longer term. Obviously, real rates are still very far in negative territory. Even the longer term interest rates are rising, they're still extremely low. So it's not an immediate term concern. But I do think ultimately what happens is rates will move up. And if rates move up faster than economic growth moves up, we suddenly have to contend with how do we pay for all of this debt that we've taken on? And that could be the real trigger point for when do we truly need to address it.
Now, what about, inflation? Because if one of the risks is rising interest rates, obviously inflation is going to have an impact on that. There are many that are saying with all this fiscal spending, with all the monetary spending, and this time with the both of them conjoined, that the likelihood of inflation is greater.
I think there are a lot of moving parts with respect to inflation, and you're absolutely spot on. If inflation is accelerating, that usually is the predominant case for why interest rates rise. So there is some sensitivity there, and we want to watch it pretty carefully. What I will say, though, is that even though we've had all of this monetary growth, even though the Fed has jumped in with an extraordinary proclivity to support economic conditions over the course of the last year, M2 is exploding, but the actual velocity of money is not. And until the velocity of money increases, it's unlikely that you're going to actually see a true inflationary outbreak. Most of the data, it still suggests very, very limited inflation pressures. Even with respect to corporate margins, one of the things we watch pretty carefully is the comparison between consumer prices and producer prices. Obviously, when producer prices start accelerating very rapidly, and consumer prices follow suit, it could be problematic for corporate margins. That's not the case we're seeing today. As a matter of fact, we just got a PPI print or a producer price print this week, and it was still less than 1% year over year. Consumer prices still growing at about 1.5% year over year. Are very benign conditions, even to in comparison to periods in time in which inflation conditions were accelerating over the last 10 years. So there's not a ton of evidence that inflation is actually rearing its ugly head. Obviously, you want to be on guard for some sort of policy error to create inflation. This is why I think markets are going to remain somewhat sensitive to the Fed. Does the Fed have it right that any sort of near-term reflation in the economy will be deemed as transitory inflation, or is there something more ominous at bay? Is going to be a big part of the conversation, I think, over the course of the next year. I think it's a story of reflation, not inflation, so far, which is very supportive for stock prices and probably also keeps any sort of increase in rates generally at bay. But we want to be careful and watch. I think that one of the things that we're going to contend with over the course of 2021 that we really haven't had to deal with in some time is a supply-based inflation where supply chain disruptions, you know, clearly the Biden administration has been talking a lot about the semiconductor industry specifically, but supply chain disruptions in general resulted as a function or as a result of COVID shutting down trade, shutting down economic activity in fits and starts over the course of 2020. As a result, we've been left with limited supply of certain products globally. In an environment where demand advances and you have limited amount of supply, you can have temporary price increases. What I'll say, though, is the vast majority in the United States, the vast majority of what we spend is actually on services, and services supply certainly doesn't seem to be tremendously constrained relative to demand right now. So we shouldn't see an absolute breakout in prices and inflation, but it certainly is something we want to watch for and would likely be one of the predominant reasons for an unforecasted move higher in rates. In addition to the Fed, I mean, I think you want to watch the Fed very closely, too, because the Fed may have to backpedal faster than anyone has anticipated, and that could also be somewhat problematic for the market come late 2021 or 2022.
What about some of the market internals? We saw, Gina, last year where most of the year the market was dominated by the tech sector. Recently, we've seen tech pull back. You've got over the last week, you've got energy and financial services doing well, which you would expect if the economy is recovering. What about the internals of the market? What are you seeing there?
Yeah, I think actually we've had a really healthy rotation. We saw tech really peak relative to the S&P 500 in terms of performance all the way back in September, and we've seen the market move toward more smaller cap, broader performance, value-oriented type of recovery over the course of the last several months. That's only expanded so far this year, where we've seen small caps start to really, really catch fire since the November election, but even more so since the beginning of 2021. So I would say what we have is a broadening market, a market that was highly concentrated in very defensive, high quality strategies where investors were kind of hiding in what they felt were the most defendable earnings stream in the S&P 500. They're now starting to broaden out and taking a greater degree of risk. We're also seeing it in emerging markets relative to developed markets. Emerging markets are finally breaking out of a range that they've been in since 2018. So generally a broadening of performance to groups that were laggards in early 2020 has been the story for the last several months, and we think will continue to be the story for much of 2021 as these groups play catch up. They tend to benefit more from economic reopening as opposed to economic shutdown. They benefit more from a more risk-tolerant investor base as opposed to a risk-averse investor base and the like.
What about what we're starting to see is a breakout in a lot of the commodity stocks? You take a look at copper gold producer Freeport, BHP, and even the oil stocks themselves. What about commodities now?
Yeah, very consistent with the reflation story at the very least. I don't know how much it is a play on inflation as much as it is the notion that economies are going to get back to functioning. Trade will get back to functioning over the course of 2021, and commodities are an immediate beneficiary of a cyclical recovery. Certainly, Bloomberg's commodity index has surged a lot over the course of the last several months, really bottoming around the time that stocks bottomed in the spring of 2020, but has certainly continuously shown recovery over the course of the latter part of 2020 and into early 2021. All of these, to me, are positive signals of better performance, better risk on for the equity market. Now, will we see energy stocks perform as outperformers longer term? If you actually look at the charts, energy relative to the S&P 500, maybe in a bottoming process, but certainly hasn't broke higher. As a matter of fact, we're still below our even January relative to S&P 500 level for the energy sector. Financials look a little bit more positive. Financials certainly the direct beneficiary of an upward sloping yield curve, maybe a bigger, more stronger driver than commodities are for an earnings recovery in the S&P 500. So I think you want to watch these plays and distinguish between them. You know, rates are driving financials, reflation certainly driving energy materials. Will reflation turn into inflation? Because that's probably what's going to be required for the energy stocks to perform better longer term. Financials to us has more legs because the yield curve is becoming more upward sloping, and the profitability of financials we think will improve and really prove to be the driver of performance of that space over the course of 2021.
Do you think, given where the market is now and some areas that seem to be overinflated, when you look at the Teslas or, you know, you're looking at cryptocurrencies, do you see that play translating into value over growth, or is it going to be a combination of both or neither?
What I actually see, so I think it depends on your perspective, right? A lot of people look at value and growth as the long-only portion of the market, and on that side of the equation, growth is still largely beating value. We really have not seen enough recovery in value to suggest that value is prime for outperformance. It's one of our themes over the course of 2020. We started to migrate to value as a factor, but that's the long short factor. And what we meant by that is value as a factor outperforms because either the long side of value, the value-oriented companies outperform, or the non-value companies underperform. And this is really a consequence of what happened with tech. Tech are the low-value companies in the value factor. They started to underperform in September. We think that tech is likely to maintain sort of a market perform while the rest of the market starts to broaden, and that will work for the value factor. But does it work for value long only? Not necessarily. What we need to see is much better earnings revision momentum emerge for groups like energy, for groups like materials, industrials, for that value, that long-only leg of value to perform better. We have not seen that en masse yet. As a matter of fact, over the course of the fourth quarter earnings season, we saw the value trade lose a little bit of momentum. The long-only value trade lost a little bit of momentum because that those groups did not produce the upward revision momentum that some of their counterparts in the rest of the index produced. What I can say with relative certainty is what we do believe in is cyclical over defensive. Some people blend cyclical with value. There is a lot of blend there, but it's not precise and it's not comprehensive. But we do believe that cyclical should generally outperform defensive. Anything with a sensitivity to economic growth is generally going to, in our minds, outperform fundamentally and in price groups in the market that are more defensive in nature. But I think value growth is really, you have to be careful how you classify it and what groups you're really talking about when you say value growth. It does matter. And it matters. It has pretty strong consequences for investment strategy.
So given where we are right now, as an investor, what would you tell an investor to do here?
Oh, I think that we're so early in the economic cycle. It's still very clear to me that you want to keep, you know, obviously, let me first caveat with it depends upon your longer term strategy. And when you mean investor, who is the investor? It does matter. You know, what is your risk tolerance level? What is your longer term plan? What is your strategy? What are your goals? All of those things matter and have extraordinary meaning for what to do with your portfolio. But to the extent that you do have the tolerance for taking on some degree of risk, to the extent that you would like to see a probably high single digit risk adjusted return for your portfolio, then I do think you want to have meaningful exposure to the equity market. I mean, if you think back to the last cycle coming out of the 2009 recession, 2010 proved to be a relatively volatile year, but nonetheless, a year in which stock prices did continue to rise and set off a decade-long outperformance for the equity market. It's very typical coming out of economic recession that you see very strong gains and then investors start to question those gains, but you're so early in an economic recovery cycle right now that you do want to have exposure to risky assets and assets that are somewhat levered to improving economic conditions and economic expansion. And so I do think you want to have some exposure to the stock market, despite the fact that a lot of people are definitely still somewhat hesitant to do so. I think there's still plenty of value left in equities.
All right. Well, listen, Gina, I know that you write for Bloomberg Terminals, but if our listeners would like to follow your work, how could they do so?
Yeah, well, to the extent that they're a Bloomberg subscriber, thank you. They can find me on the Bloomberg just by searching my name, Gina Martin Adams, or going to my page on the Bloomberg Terminal, which is BI, that's Bloomberg Intelligence, BI space STOX for stocks. You can find all of our work stored there. Alternatively, if you're not a Bloomberg client, you probably should consider becoming one. But in case you don't want to consider becoming one, you can find bits and pieces of my work on LinkedIn or Twitter. And I'm Gina Martin Adams on both LinkedIn and Twitter.
All right. Well, listen, Gina, as always, thanks for coming on the program. Stay safe and warm and come back again.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks for having me as usual.
If you thought it was big news when Tesla announced their $1.5 billion purchase of Bitcoin, just wait until headlines start coming out about central banks also diversifying their rapidly depreciating U.S. dollar holdings, not just into gold, as they've been doing, but also into Bitcoin. That's the prediction being made by Bloomberg strategist Mike McGlone, who we spoke with on FS Insider this week.
The biggest holders of gold on the planet and biggest allocators, biggest buyers the last few years have been central banks, most notably trying to diversify away from the dollar, which makes sense. And if they see the holdings of their old guard gold value declining because of this new digital upcomer, it's just prudent to diversify. To me, that's an iteration that's down the road, and it was predicted by Saifedean Ammous in his book, Bitcoin Standard. I read that a few years ago. I did not agree with him, and now I do.
As Mike forecasted last year on his show, he still believes Bitcoin is on track to hit 100,000 and also discussed how people can invest around a commodity supercycle, which he believes is underway when it comes to metals and energy. To listen to this full interview, in addition to the three interviews that we air every week on FS Insider, either through our website or through a podcast app of your choice, all you have to do is go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Do you find yourself reacting to market news, selling when you should be buying, and buying when you should be selling? Are you making costly investment mistakes? It's time to take control and develop a plan that keeps your investments centered, no matter what direction the markets take. We can help you protect your investments during market downturns and profit when markets rise. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management to create an investment strategy today. Call 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, Congress is in the mood to spend money. And not just any money, I'm talking big money. And what will this mean for the economy and inflation? Well, let's find out. Joining us on the program is Ryan Sweet from Moody Analytics. And Ryan, one of your articles recently talked about a return of inflation, but you think that this could be only temporary. Let's get into that and explain why.
So I think we're already starting to see some evidence of, you know, a pickup in inflationary pressures in the U.S. You know, for example, today we got the producer price index, and that there's a little bit of a pop in January. Some of the increase is attributed to higher energy prices, but also some is COVID-related supply chain disruptions, which is driving up, you know, transportation costs along with commodity prices. So that's going to put some upward pressure over the next few months on producer prices, import prices, and consumer prices in the U.S. But one big factor why we're going to see a noticeable pickup in inflation is that year-over-year comparisons are going to become very, very favorable or very easy in the first half of this year, because some of the big declines that we saw in inflation this time last year, you know, they're going to still be in the calculation. So you're going to see a pickup in, or excuse me, they drop out. So you're going to see an acceleration in inflation, but it's transitory because the underlying fundamentals, aging population, technology, all these are going to help limit the inflationary pressures in the second half of this year and into next year.
So when you take a look at what's happened as a result of COVID, a lot of businesses, Ryan, have actually gone under, whether it's restaurants, you know, nail salons, a lot of service-oriented businesses. And then also there's been some supply bottlenecks in manufacturing. Do you see that resolving itself over the next 12 to 18 months?
Well, it's going to take time to fully heal from the COVID recession. Hopefully, some of the businesses that you shut down are start back up. I think the various rounds of the payroll protection program and federal aid towards unemployed workers, those that have seen hours cut because of the COVID crisis, yeah, that should help lay and plant the seeds for a stronger recovery once we're on the other side of the pandemic. And, you know, based on, you know, daily immunizations, it looks like we could achieve herd immunity, which is roughly 70 to 75% of the population 16 years and older having been vaccinated, you know, late this summer, early fall. So I do think that the economy is poised to really take off once we're on the other side of the pandemic.
So you just reported that retail sales really surged. Consumers are in the mood to spend money, and the government is giving them money. Do you see that trend continuing? In other words, once the stimulus works off, and hopefully the economy will be in the recovery mode, do you still see the strong consumer participating and driving this economy?
Yes, I think the consumer is going to continue to power the economy forward. But again, when within consumer spending, at least for the next 6 months or so, it's going to still be concentrated towards consumer goods and online shopping. So there's going to be, those are going to be the winners over the next 6 months. The area of consumer spending that's continuing to be hurt significantly by the pandemic is consumer services, restaurants, hotels, travel, bars, bowling alleys, barbershops. Consumers, we're not able to spend because people are social distancing. There's tighter restrictions by local and state governments on a lot of the consumer services. But I think their recovery will begin. It's going to be a long recovery, but that will begin on the other side of the pandemic once we reach herd immunity. And even if by then, the fiscal stimulus, the impulse from the fiscal stimulus has waned, consumers are sitting on, in aggregate, an enormous amount of savings. And this was forced savings. We weren't able to go out to restaurants, so we saved that money. But once we're on the other side of the pandemic, we have roughly, as of right now, $1.5 trillion in forced savings. That's going to flow out into the economy over time. And that's going to support, both consumer spending, but also broader economic activity.
Ryan, have you guys done any study or any research into how this economy will change as a result of COVID? For example, we're seeing stocks like Peloton and other companies like that rise as people don't go to gyms. We've seen Netflix take off because people aren't going to movie theaters. We're seeing companies talking about, well, maybe we don't need as much commercial office space. So what about the structure of the economy as we come out of this?
Yeah, I think there's going to be, you know, some changes. I mean, it's difficult to go through a shock of this magnitude without, some underlying changes. But I think it's too early to call whether or not, these are going to be big structural changes, like, a large portion of the population works from home more often. So I do think, over time, we'll get a better feel of the structural changes. I do think, the demand for commercial real estate will remain weak for the next couple of years. I think more people have more of a hybrid type work approach where, they work from home some days or in the office and others. But right now, there's not signs that, structural unemployment is going to be higher post-pandemic, because what we've learned following the Great Recession is that time heals a lot of these wounds, and that we can get the job market back to where it was pre-COVID, hopefully even better. But it just takes time and for the economy to heal and for us to get back to where we were before the pandemic began.
And what about, another thing that they're working on in Washington? The Trump administration talked about this. Biden's doing the same, an infrastructure bill where they're talking about $2 trillion. I don't know if it's all going to be towards green energy or, just things like the transportation system, airports. There are a lot of things, and also the electrical grid system, as we're seeing some of the issues emerge here with Texas.
Yeah, I think an infrastructure bill is likely. We have that penciled into our forecast for the second half of this year that it gets, approved. But that impact on the economy wouldn't be in the second quarter, because it takes time for, to approve projects and for them to begin. So the economic impact would be delayed, roughly by a year, maybe a year and a half. But then, the infrastructure boost to the economy will begin to kick in. It's important that they do this right. There's no need to rush it. We really want a well thought out infrastructure bill, because it will have both near term economic positives, generating more jobs, in construction and engineering. But it will have longer term economic implications if done right. Because investing in education, transportation will all increase productivity. And when we increase productivity, that increases the economy's speed limit. And that's something that would be very, very important to do in a well thought out infrastructure bill.
We've gotten to the point where the economy seems to be in need of stimulus. I mean, Trump stimulated the economy with his tax cuts on the corporate side, the individual side. They had additional spending bills, obviously, because of COVID and what was happening in the economy. But it seems like it's almost like we are on this stimulus treadmill. Do you see that abating at some time in the future?
I do, because it's going to be necessary to get our fiscal house in order. But unlike in following the Great Recession, we don't need to get the fiscal house in order and shift to austerity soon. We, it doesn't have to be, later this year, next year, or even in 2023 or 2024. Once the economy has fully healed, that's a time when you can go back and say, maybe we need to raise taxes or cut government spending. That time will come, but for the next few years, that it's not appropriate, because we still have this K-shaped type recovery where, it's, a has versus have not type of economy. And we need to address that. And the best way to do that is with, targeted fiscal stimulus, getting money in people's pockets that are most adversely affected by this pandemic. Because one way to get your fiscal house in order, is to run the economy hot. Get as many people working as possible, increase government revenues. Last thing we want to do is prematurely shift to fiscal austerity like we did before. And that will take a lot of wind. That would take a lot of wind out of the economy sales. But I think what the Biden administration's plan is just, let's really try to get the economy back to full employment as soon as possible. And I think that is the correct approach.
Do you think they'll hold off with taxes? I know the Obama administration waited till his second term before they raised taxes to make sure that the economy was on a sound footing. And one of the mistakes that I think was made early on, they had the initial stimulus, but then they went to austerity. So do you think they'll hold off on taxes? In other words, if you're going to push money into the economy with fiscal stimulus, as they're talking about now, but then turn around and then raise major taxes, do you think they'll wait on that?
I do. I think they learned from policy errors after the Great Recession. Yellen was there at the Fed. You know, Powell continues to stress the importance of not making the same mistakes that were made back after the Great Recession. So I do think they'll hold off on that. And, you know, there are some concerns. You know, you're starting to see some chatter in the bond market or in the press that, you know, we're going to see high inflation soon because of all the fiscal stimulus, because of the expansion of the Fed's balance sheet. But, you know, in hindsight, when we look back, if we didn't generate enough economic activity or use enough stimulus to get inflation slightly above the Fed's target, then that was a policy error because this pandemic has been an enormous economic shock. And, you know, fiscal policy has been very aggressive. Monetary policy has been very aggressive. But we got to make sure we do enough to get the economy back to full employment as soon as possible. And if that, you know, means a little bit of, you know, high inflation, no, I don't think that's the end of the world because the Fed has all the tools it needs to tame any inflationary pressures that develop.
And Ryan, what about the international markets? Because the United States is more of a self-contained economy. In other words, we export less, or exports are less important to the U.S. compared to, let's say, in an economy like Japan or, let's say, Germany.
Yeah, I think that with a stronger U.S. economy, that will lift, you know, other countries' economies. You know, it's not, you know, rising tide lifts all boats. It's not going to be universally felt. But I do think, you know, as the U.S. economy begins to pick up, that will start to benefit Canada, China, Mexico. They'll start to Europe. They'll start to reap the benefits of, you know, stronger economic activity in the U.S. because we import a lot of goods because, you know, the U.S. consumer, you know, we can't produce everything that the U.S. consumer needs. So we import a lot of goods and services. And that will benefit our trading partners over the next couple of years. In the near term, with, you know, rising commodity prices, I think it's less of an issue for many developed economies, but for some emerging economies, that could prove more problematic. That could cause some of those central banks, you know, in South Africa or in Brazil to consider, you know, maybe pausing or not cutting interest rates any further. And then if the increase in commodity prices is, you know, continues, they may have to consider raising interest rates. But again, that's more of an emerging market story, whereas the developed economies, I think, are not going to be as sensitive to the increase in commodity prices.
In looking at this economic recovery, where you have the Fed basically saying, look, we're going to remain on pause for quite some time here. Now you have the stimulus coming in the first half of the year, and the second half of the year you may get infrastructure stimulus. Is this a situation, Ryan, where you can see this economic recovery going well into, let's say, 2022, 23, and 24?
Yeah, I think this recovery is going to take a few years, but it's going to be a lot faster than, you know, the Great Recession. It took us almost 10 years to fully recover from the financial crisis and the ensuing recession. But I always try to avoid comparing, you know, this recovery to the last one, you know, after the Great Recession, because it's really apples and oranges. The catalyst for this one is, you know, more similar to a natural disaster where, you know, we had the pandemic, state economy shut non-essential businesses. So that's more like what you see after a natural disaster. Whereas before, after the Great Recession, that was, you know, we had a financial crisis, and there's been a lot of research that shows economic recoveries are a lot slower because after a financial crisis, because you got to repair the banking's balance sheet, corporations' balance sheets, and household balance sheets. Fortunately, this time around, the banking system was well capitalized, and you know, we don't need to repair banks' balance sheets. So hopefully, credit flows more quickly as we get to see stronger economic activity develop over the next couple of years. Whereas after the Great Recession, you know, it took some time before, you know, banks were lending, you know, aggressively.
So given your outlook, this should be a good year. And do you think we get to that 6% growth rate that they're talking about? I know the Trump administration wanted to talk about 3 and 4% growth rates. I think we achieved that in one or two quarters, but that was it. So your long-term growth rate for this economy, what does it look like?
It really hasn't changed substantially, pre versus post-pandemic. You know, our estimate of potential GDP growth is between 2 and 2.25%. That's very similar to what we're estimating pre-pandemic. So, you know, the takeaway from that is that we don't think there's going to be these, you know, enormous structural changes or higher structural unemployment because of the pandemic. We expect this economy to fully heal. Now, that's what's sustainable. The next couple of years, we're going to see GDP numbers that, you know, are really encouraging. It's a good sign for the economy. It's going to help the labor market, but they're not going to be, you know, the new norm. So our forecast is 5% GDP growth this year and 5% GDP growth next year. I actually think the risks to our forecast are tilted to the upside. You highlighted, you know, 6% GDP growth. I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility for this year. But again, we got to, you know, keep in mind that this is being boosted by a reduction in forced savings, very favorable financial market conditions, a ton of fiscal stimulus. So we're going to get, you know, a booming economy for a couple of years, but then we'll have to settle back down into a more sustainable pace of growth, which is closer to 2%.
All right. Well, listen, Ryan, as we close, you guys cover a lot of economic data at Moody's Analytics. You not only cover the domestic markets, but you cover international markets. So if our listeners would like to find out more about the great work you guys do, how could they do so?
You can visit our website. It's economy.com. And on this website, you'll be able to see all the various products that we offer. And the one that I focus most on is EconomicsView, which is our real-time economic analysis platform where we cover, you know, almost 300 economic indicators.
It's one of the best in the business. Well, listen, Ryan, thanks so much for joining us on the program. All the best. Stay safe and come back again.
Millions of people are without power in Texas. And as we've been discussing on our show for the past few months, there's some very interesting trends shaping up when we think about the energy space, increased demand, lack of supply, and obviously a lot of changes on the policy front. So we're going to get into some of those big issues today. So Jim, let's first start off talking about the Texas power outs and who is to blame.
When you take a look at this, the problem that we have today is we have different forms of media that we get our news sources from. We have network television, cable television, we have the internet, you've got blogs. And the problem is when you're looking at a problem, as we are seeing here with Texas, where, you know, it's a serious issue because a lot of people have died because of the cold weather with lack of heating with the winter storm. It's who you get your information from. So, for example, if you're listening to CNN, everything's climate change. On the other hand, if you're listening to Fox, it's all about, you know, the Green New Deal. And so the problem that we have today is that much of our journalism today is opinion journalism rather than somebody just reporting the facts and people can draw their own conclusions. So if you take a look at what was going on with Texas, the system was not set up to handle unusually cold weather. And it wasn't just the wind turbines, the solar panels that weren't working. It was also the natural gas fired plants. And a lot of Texas gets a lot of its power, over 40% of its power from natural gas plants. And I think it's about 23 to 25% that they're getting from wind turbines. The problem is with the colder temperatures, a lot of that gas, they couldn't get it. It wasn't working. A lot of the natural gas powered plants don't keep a lot of inventory online. You had the pipelines not working, supply not working. So it was just a mishmash of different things that all went wrong at the same time because the system wasn't designed to handle severe weather as Texas is now experiencing with this winter storm.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, Jim. I was looking into it and apparently this was something I didn't realize is that Texas has its own energy grid. It's the only state in the entire United States that has its very own energy grid disconnected from the two other ones, which are on the West and the East Coast. So as far as I understand, if they do run into problems, they're not hooked into the other ones so that they can receive backup power, which was also a complicating factor in this as well.
Well, Chris, the issue is not just Texas. It's many states in this country that have different laws. For example, California, you're only allowed to use California blend gasoline. So if you have a refinery outage in Los Angeles, where most of the refiners are located, and you want to get extra gasoline into the state, you can't do it because we don't allow gasoline from other states. And likewise with even our power, a lot of our power demands are met from electricity provided by nuclear power plants in Arizona. So when you're looking at these blackouts, brownouts, power outs as you have in Texas, Chris, it really gets down to the grid itself, and which brings up the American Society of Civil Engineers. They're about ready to release their 2021 report, but the last report they did was 2017. And when you look at the energy grid, it's been given about a D+. States like California and Texas are a little better. They get a C. But if you look at any state, California, Texas, every state is a little bit different. But more importantly, the nation's energy grid, whether it's roads, bridges, electricity, highway systems, airports, all of this has been given an overall rating by the civil engineers of a D+, which is not good. So, you know, we need to spend literally trillions of dollars to upgrade the nation's infrastructure, because if we don't, we're going to have more of what you're seeing in Texas, what you see in California so often, in other states.
You know, Jim, as you know, we've spoken with Casey Dinges at the American Society of Civil Engineers on our podcast a number of different times about the need for infrastructure. And one of those things was the very dilapidated and aging electrical grid. And it's very interesting. If you go to their website, and you can all do this, if you just go to infrastructurereportcard.org, the last one that they did was in 2017. And as you mentioned, Jim, they're going to be producing another one this year, starting next month in March. But here's what they say, tying this directly to what we see in Texas about the energy system. They write, some parts of the U.S. electric grid predate the turn of the 20th century. Most lines were constructed in the 50s and the 60s with a 50-year life expectancy and were not originally engineered to meet today's demand, nor severe weather events. With more than 640,000 miles of high-voltage transmission lines across the three interconnected electrical transmission grids, the Eastern, Western, and Texas interconnection, again, Texas having its own, separate from the East and West, the lower 48 states' power grid is at full capacity, with many lines operating well beyond their design. And they talk about the increase in the number of outages that we see across the U.S., the amount of time that people are going without power, and how this is specifically putting the U.S. economy at risk, since so much of the U.S. economy today depends on electricity, the internet, and a lot of services that require electricity. So that was something that we discussed with Casey on our program extensively in the past. And they also talk about the switch to renewables, how that is going to be factoring into that as well. Something that I'm sure is going to be featuring prominently in their report next month.
Well, the unfortunate thing is we want to transition to the green economy, and we're moving so quickly that we're not thinking through the consequences of transitioning to a green economy. Just as you mentioned, Texas, you know, when you think of Texas and weather, you think of thunderstorms, you think of hurricanes, of flooding, you don't think of snow and sub-zero temperatures. And that's the issue when you're thinking about energy. Okay, we want to transition to EVs, which if you're concerned about climate change, pollution, is supposed to be better. But there's a lot of raw materials that go into producing green energy. And on top of that, Chris, if we're all going to be driving EVs, nobody's thinking about the electricity grid, the electrical grid in this country, which is in very poor shape, as we're seeing in some of these outages in Texas or the brownouts in California. And so if we're going to be moving to EVs, we need to think about, all right, that means at night you're going to be charging your car in the garage, drawing on the grid. You're also going to need to set up charging stations around, just like we have gas stations. You're going to have charging stations. You know, how are you going to get transportation? How are trucks going to get goods to the store or from state to state? Or airlines? You know, airlines are still going to be running on jet fuel. Although, Chris, I just saw a small little plane that was run on batteries. So, you know, whether, you know, you'll be flying around on a 787 on batteries, I don't know about that yet. But nonetheless, everything, even I'm seeing it enter the recreation space where you're looking at not only trucks, off-road vehicles, but even in sailboats. You know, I have a German-made sailboat, and one of the options they have now is an electrical motor instead of a diesel motor. Sailboats don't use much diesel fuel because you're mainly relying on wind. But if, you know, the wind isn't blowing, you need to get in and out of the slip or around, you use diesel fuel. Well, now you're starting to see the electric motor option being put in boats. So we're going to get there, but it's going to involve a lot of things. It's going to involve raw materials. It's going to involve changing the electrical grid and making it more reliable. Maybe that's where we need to go next.
One of our listeners, Dwayne Roth, he actually had notified me that there's a company just down the street from where we live here in San Diego called Aptera, and they've now developed a solar-powered vehicle. And apparently it can go about 20 miles per day in the winter and 40 miles in the summer. So they're trying to push the boundaries of what's possible. If you want to check it out, it's aptera.us. So, you know, there's some people out there that are making some pretty good strides here when it comes to renewable energy. However, again, we're not going to see a full scaling away from fossil fuels to renewable energy when we're talking about electricity production. And I think that's the main thing we have to keep in mind going forward.
Yeah, if you take a look, according to the Energy Information Agency, renewables make up about 17% of the country's electricity. Nuclear is about 20%. Coal is 23%. And natural gas is 38%. So if you take a look at 60% or more of the nation's electricity comes from fossil fuels. So, you know, we still are going to need natural gas. We still need coal because coal provides a lot of electricity. Now, one of the problems that we have now with the new administration, they're going after fossil fuels and they're restricting access to federal lands. And, you know, they're doing things like killing the Keystone Pipeline. So the question is, how are you going to power the electricity in this country? And going green is going to require more energy from the electric grid. And it's not just going to be charging your car at night. It's going to be charging stations around the country. And when we talk about going green, we're also talking about raw materials. The problem that we have, wind and solar is not going to do it. It's too intermittent. The renewable energy network can only be built, maintained, and operated with fossil fuels. So the government is mandating green energy while restricting fossil fuel production. Chris, it's going to lead to higher energy prices and probably mid-decade. I don't know if it's going to be 2023, 2024. We could have a energy spike or an energy crisis because, and we'll get into this in just a minute, but the real important thing here that we really got to think through, Chris, is a reliable source of electricity if we're going to go to this green economy with electric vehicles and the transportation system. And it's not just going to be one fuel. And a good example is Texas. Texas has natural gas is over 40% of their energy needs. And then wind and solar is about 23-25%. In this case, with this unusual weather, neither of those worked. They both broke down. They couldn't get as much natural gas as they needed, and they couldn't get the power from the wind turbines. So you've got to have a diverse energy source, but you got to have one that's more reliable. Because just as we saw these winter storms, what is going to supply a reliable source of electricity? And Chris, I don't think we can rely on just one source. So you're going to have to see nuclear. You're going to have to see natural gas. You'll probably have to see coal in there along with renewables. But to exclude fossil fuels and say, no, it's all going to be green, it's not going to work.
It seems at the end of the day, both sides are going to agree that we, again, need to be investing money into our infrastructure because, you know, a lot of this stuff is 50 to 100 years old. As you noted, American Society of Civil Engineers giving our infrastructure a D+. I mean, it's almost failing, right? So that's going to be perhaps the next thing that's down the road under a Biden administration.
Yep. And so, you know, the real key is when this is proposed, is the input. Somebody's looking at this from a non-political point of view, because what happens is, you know, politicians, they want to get reelected. They run on money to finance their campaigns. The money comes from donors, and there's a tendency in Washington to reward donors rather than to do the most efficient or the right thing. So this could end up being a boondoggle, or it could actually really put America on track. And simply at this point, you don't know.
Well, Jim, let's talk about some of the investment implications. I know that you are investing around many of these things that we discussed today. Of course, we at Financial Sense Wealth Management are managing our clients' money in many of these areas around not just energy, but also around green technology and how to profit from that as well.
Well, I think if you look at the energy sector, it's probably been the worst performing sector in the S&P over the last decade. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, it's down to about 2.3% of the S&P. And so I think a lot of these energy stocks are underowned and undervalued. And I think it's one of the main reasons why you saw somebody like Warren Buffett pick up a major investment in Chevron. So we like energy. When it comes to green, you know, I don't know who's going to be, you know, the car company on top. Is it going to be Tesla? Is it going to be Volkswagen? Is more and more car companies from Toyota, Tesla, GM, they're all going towards electric vehicles, phasing out gas combustion engines. But one thing I do know, Chris, they're all, when you talk about green needs copper. Yeah, you know, an electrical car consumes about four times the amount of copper. And that's not talking about the charging stations. You need nickel for batteries. You need silver for solar. So we're invested in nickel, copper, silver, and we own energy because I think this is going to be a decade, a super cycle for commodities. And it's not just going to be the what I call the green commodities like copper, nickel, and silver. It's also going to be natural gas. It's going to be energy. It's going to be ags. It's going to be fertilizer. And a lot of that is going to be driven in some part by monetary fusion. So, you know, we like this space, especially when you're looking at the market today, when prices of some things have just skyrocketed, where some of these companies are worth trillions of dollars and the market cap of many companies, they're soaring. And so if you look at what might do well, as Gina was talking earlier in the program, some of the sectors that are really starting to perform now are finance and also energy. Energy on the basis that the economy is going to pick up steam, finance that the yield curve is rising. So we just happen to like the commodity space, and we think this is going to be one of the main performing sectors over the next decade.
Well, as always, if you want to contact any of our financial advisors here to assist you in your investment needs, whether or not that's for financial planning or asset management, give us a call at 888-486-3939. Or you can also go to financialsense.com and hit where it says contact us.
In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until we talk again, stay safe and have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.